Revelation 7, verse 9 is where we've left off and where we want to start. You may remember that in the material that we talked about last week, John talks about the 144,000, and we'll mention this a little bit later in class, but how do we get to the number 144,000? Anybody remember? We take 12 times 12, which brings us to 144, and we say when we start doubling Bible numbers, what's that do? It's kind of like stars for a hotel. You go from a 2-star to a 3-star. You're increasing, you're amplifying it. So 12 is that number that symbolizes what? Organized religion. Remember, we've got the 12 apostles, we've got the 12 tribes. 12 is used throughout the Bible. All right, so we have 144, 12 times 12. But we're still a little short of 144,000. So how do we get the other number, 100,000? We take 10 times 10, which is 100. And then that 100 times another 10, which is 1,000. So we've taken that number 10, and once again, we've multiplied it by itself. We've cubed the number to symbolize, what does 10 tell us? 10 is also a number of completeness. So we've taken completeness plus completeness plus completeness. And the two numbers, organized religion, amplified, and the organized organization described by the number 10 brings us to 144,000. We talked about the tribes. Mentioned the fact that John does mention 12 tribes, but these do not match up with the Old Testament lists, and he seems to have done that to indicate he's not talking about literal Israel, but he's using this Old Testament analogy to describe the saved. So 144,000, not a literal number, but the symbolical value there, designed to say this is a symbolic figure to describe all the redeemed, all the saved, all the righteous. We now pick up with Revelation 7:9. After these things I saw, and behold, a great multitude, which no man could number, out of every nation, out of all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, arrayed in white robes and palms in their hands. Sometimes when people look at the expression there in Revelation 7:9, after these things, they think, well, okay, the vision in Revelation 7, verses 1 through 8 is done, and now John is describing another vision. It's possible that this is what it means. I think I favor a slightly different view, and this would be that this is kind of the second phase of the same vision. That is, John's continuing with the information, but he's providing some additional information and offering really the same material, but he's offering it from a different perspective. One of the things that inclines me to draw this conclusion is the writer. When we were going through the book of 1 John, we noted that John would introduce a subject, and then he kind of steps back from it for a little while, and then it's kind of like a spiral staircase. He deals with it, stops, and then, okay, second level, let's talk about it again, but let's look at it from a different perspective, pauses for a minute, and then says, okay, we're going to go around the barn again, but I'm going to take you a different direction. So this seems to be a stylistic thing with John, and we know he did that in the book of 1 John several times throughout the book, and to me it seems at least possible and very likely probable that this is what he does here. We've already talked about the 144,000 in verse 4, and it seems to me, especially when you consider that this is a numerical figure, that John may have been saying, okay, from God's perspective, 144,000, not literally, but from God's perspective, you do the symbols, and it's a way of saying it's a complete, it's a vast number of people, it's all the righteous. Well, maybe from our perspective, that's not the best way to describe it. So maybe John's saying, and I think this is right, John's saying, okay, from the human perspective, how would we describe it? When we think about the saved, what's our view? People from where? Everywhere. All over the earth. And a few people or many people? Lots of folks. I mean, when you begin to think about the redeemed, even Christians, all the people who will be saved during the Christian era, and if John's including the people prior to the time of the Christian era, I mean, it is a great multitude. So from our perspective, great multitude makes sense. So it seems to me that John, the 144,000, is just another way of describing the great multitude, but perhaps we're looking at it from two different perspectives. God's perspective, the 144,000, our perspective, this great multitude that no man can number. Now, do you think it's literally possible to number the people who are going to be saved?
Not for us, but for God.
You don't think we could count that high?
Oh, count that high? I thought you meant in the matter of
right.
Exactly.
Right. But, he doesn't mean without number in the sense that, it would be impossible. I mean, probably take a long time. But it's kind of like what we find back there in Genesis chapter 32, verse 12. Abraham's descendants. Remember what God said? They're going to be without number. Well, that's not literally true. when God said it's going to be like the sand on the sea, could we count every, you know, grain of sand on the sea? You don't think we could? If we were given eternity and we went grain by grain, couldn't we do it?
Well, maybe.
Well, yeah. I mean, not in a lifetime. Not in a lifetime. But, you know, it would be theoretically possible if God said, okay, you've got forever to do it. And, you know, we're going to give you one super calculator. So, I mean, from our perspective, it's not possible. But technically, if we had enough time and the resources, we could do it. And John, as he describes this group, he says they came from which nation? Every nation or all nations. And then he talks about the tribes, the peoples, and the tongues. If you think about these descriptions, every nation, every tribe, every tongue, and we're thinking about the Christian era especially, what comes to mind as far as another New Testament reference? Jesus said, go where?
All the world.
All the world. Preach the gospel. Well, if you do that, what are you going to find? People from all nations, all tribes, all tongues, or all languages are going to become Christians. So when John sees this picture, this great multitude, he really seems to be describing what Jesus had in mind as far as the Great Commission. It's also possible that there's some background information here relative to Rome. You know, we hear sometimes that America is this great melting pot. We've got people from all over the world coming here. And our nation, in many respects, does have a lot of different cultures represented. We talk about Chinatown or, you know, we've got the Asian store over here and a lot of different things in our particular culture. Rome was like that as well. Rome was like a great melting pot. So when these Christians received this information, for them it would have made sense in their culture, kind of like us. I mean, we can see maybe not every culture represented in America, but certainly quite a few. Anything that you want to add or ask over that before we talk about the standing? All right, as John receives this information, he says that this group, which we're defining as the saved, he says they were standing where?
Before the throne.
Now, what if John says that they were in some other position? And you could just kind of take your, you know, what if they were all hunched over? Or what if they were, you know, kneeling or sitting? Why picture these folks as standing? What's that suggest? You've got God's people, the righteous, they're standing. All right, I think you may have the idea of praise here. Anything else?
Respect.
All right, respect. He's also going to talk about these people that have come out of the Great Tribulation. This will give us, I think, maybe another clue. You come out of the Great Tribulation and you're standing. What's that sound like?
Victory.
It sounds like victory, doesn't it? So I think you've got a basis there for praise because of what's happened and some other good answers. But once again, when he says they're standing, it sounds like these people are successful. Then we also have some information about what they were holding. When we think about their standing before the throne, once again, I do not think that we're probably dealing with a literal throne. You know, God's not going to be sitting up on, you know, 24-karat throne as we might think of it in terms of an earthly ruler. But throne would represent things like God's power, his rule, authority, and items such as that. And also you have a reference to before the Lamb. Now we've talked about, especially back in Revelation 5, verses 9 and 10, the fact that Christians are, in a certain sense, reigning with Christ right now. That's something that takes place in this life. So when John says this great multitude, which we've identified as being synonymous with 144,000, he says they're dressed, they're arrayed in what? They're wearing white robes. Now, a lot of people, when they look at this, they think, well, hey, that's got to be a reference to heaven. You know, we think about white and purity, and folks are going to be, you know, running around in silk or satin or whatever is nice and comfy in heaven. I don't think so. If this refers to Christians as we go through life, which I maintain it does. Do we wear white robes in this life?
Our heart should.
All right. Not literally, but remember 1 John 1 verse 7, if we walk in the light, as he's in the light, what's the blood of Christ do?
Jesus.
All right, are we white? We've been washed in the blood of the Lamb. We sing about that, don't we? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are your garments white? Well, is that song a lie or does it tell the truth? It tells the truth. So, not literally, I mean, we don't know exactly what it's going to be like in heaven. I suppose God could put people in white. But when he talks about being arrayed in white robes, it is a reference to salvation. And then look at verse 14, same chapter. And I say unto him, my Lord, thou knowest. And he said, these are they that have come out of the great tribulation. Anybody remember It's been a little while since we talked about it, but anybody remember how we've defined the Great Tribulation?
Sin.
All right. It's the worst problem that man has. If we've come out of the Great Tribulation, if we've left sin, what have we done? We have that victory. And then at the end of verse 14, notice what else has said. They've washed their robes and made them white. How? In the blood of the Lamb. When do we do that? All right, when we're baptized, right? So we're not going to be up in heaven every, you know, got Jesus' blood there and we're all going to be dipping our robes. No, this is something that takes place. This is something that happens in this life. All right, so as we look at this chapter, it's my understanding and my explanation that John is describing the Christian era. As we go through life, we are, if you will, standing before the throne of God. We're standing in a forgiven state, and we honor Him as we go through our lives. Now, John describes this activity as occurring how often? It occurs is it there? In 7-9? I thought it was. It's verse 15 that I wanted. Sorry, I should have moved ahead a little bit. Therefore, are they before the throne of God? That's what we've talked about in verse 15. And they serve Him how often?
Day and night.
Now, if you think about this, on first glimpse, it might not make a lot of sense. But, you know, people think, well, yeah, that's going to be in heaven, day and night. There's going to be this continual fellowship and presence with God. Well, I don't dispute that. But if we're talking about this life, is there also a sense in which Christians serve God day and night?
I would think so.
Okay. I mean, here, that's not going to be true for us, is it? I mean, we go to sleep. So, I mean, we're not serving God literally at night.
Not continually.
All right. But if this describes Christians on earth, remember what we said? John's described Revelation 7:9. People from where? Every nation, every tribe, and every tongue. So we're in bed fast asleep. What about brethren on the other side of the world? If they're living the faithful Christian life. So when we look at our earth, what do we find as far as service and commitment to God? It's literally day and night when we look at our earth. So when we think about this, we certainly do not want to deny that it's going to take place in eternity. But once again, I think we have to look at this and see that we're really dealing with life on the earth. We stand before God. We're serving Him. We're one of His special people. And we do that in the church that Christ built. We'll say a little bit more about that. But notice what else John says here in verse 9. What do we have that we're holding, John says? We have palm branches, and they're being held where? In our hands. Now, if you go back to the Old Testament, Leviticus 23, verse 40, and we'll not read that, but you find that the Jewish people used palm branches when it was time for the Feast of the Tabernacles. And these branches symbolize some things. We've already said that these people are standing where? Positionally. They're not sitting, they're standing, which sounds a lot like victory. All right, and then you've got the palm branch in your hand. All right, one more symbol. A victory could symbolize some other things such as fruitfulness or patience. In the ancient world, a palm branch symbolized a winner. Someone who was going to be on the winning side of things. There's also, I think, some other interesting things about this. I'm obviously no expert as far as trees, and especially when it comes to palm trees. But you see those trees, especially when the hurricane strikes, they're kind of whipped back and forth, and yet they don't immediately fall over. Like many other trees, what happens with these palm trees as they're pressed over the years by the winds and various forces? Rather than snap off, what happens to them?
They bend.
They bend. They're,
they sway and bend.
And they get stronger, don't they?
Yeah.
All right. When you think about Christians, what happens to them? We think about the seals that we saw back there in Revelation chapter 6. You're pounded, you're pummeled by the things of life. What do those things do to you? They're supposed to strengthen you. Adversity should help you. So that could also be part of the background here. God's people grow stronger and stronger. They get like the tree higher and higher and better and better. I think you also have a couple of the things indicated by this imagery. People can hold something, I guess, for two reasons. Somebody says, well, here, hold this. And we really don't want to. But a lot of times, you think about the two recent presidential conventions. the Republicans, the Democrats, and the people who are there. And when their guy is up there speaking, what are they holding?
Signs.
All right, they've got a sign. Go, whichever party, you know. Yay for whoever it is. You think anybody's got a gun to their head? No. I mean, this is our guy. We want you to win. Well, when you think about those two options, you can force somebody to hold something, or you can have someone do it willingly. These people are holding palm branches. Do you think it's willing, or do you think it's unwilling?
Willing.
It's willing. It's, hey, you know, guess what? We're with the victor. We're with the winner. So when you think about that symbolically, what would that suggest as far as a person's service to God? Is it service that should be forced? Or should it be service which is willing and eager?
Willing.
Willing and eager. Hey, this is our guy. If people will do that for a political candidate, what should they do for God?
Tenfold.
This is, yeah, tenfold. This is our guy. This is our God. And we want to stand up for him. We want to serve him. We want to honor him. We want to love him. So very, very interesting image when we think about serving God and our willingness to do that. One source, and I think this is just kind of an interesting side note, I've not seen it, but he spoke of an old custom that caused people to place a little palm branch in the hands of a departed Christian at the time of burial to symbolize faith and hope. Now, I've never seen that. Anybody ever witnessed that? Little palm branch in the hands of somebody who's left this life? Interesting. So I'm not sure how long ago that was, but maybe within the last 50 or so years. All right. When you look at what we have here in 7:9, it seems to me to be a passage which shows the importance of Christ's church, the Lord's church. I say this for a couple of reasons. John, as we've mentioned, he's talking about the redeemed, the people who stand before the throne. They are the people in this life who are doing the standing. And when we think about the church, we've got passages like Ephesians 5, verse 23, where Paul says Jesus is the head of the church. He's the Savior of the body. In 7:15, a little bit later, John says John said we have fellowship with God. You know, we're in this group. If we're where? What's that key word that he uses in 7:15? These are they. They're before the throne of God. They serve him where? Day and night in his
temple.
All right, do you think God has a literal temple in heaven? Going to be out there, you know, just like we did some building maintenance the other day. Going to have to go and maintain the heavenly temple. Have somebody out there power washing the driveway. He doesn't have a literal temple. Where's his temple?
In our hearts.
His people on earth, right? Remember what Paul said in the 1 Corinthians letter, 1 Corinthians 3, verses 16 and 17, also in Ephesians 2, verse 21. How does he identify the church?
Kingdom.
Kingdom would be one description, and don't we find it identified as a temple? Yeah. So when we think about this fellowship with God, it is in, it is through, it is by the church that he built. And, you know, people sometimes say, well, you know, the church isn't important, it isn't necessary, it really doesn't matter what you believe about that. That's not right. You think about the analogy that Paul gave in Ephesians 5. What's he compare the church to? A bride. Does the bride that you have matter? Yeah, it matters. And such is also true for the Lord. All right, anything that you want to add or ask? There's a lot there in 7:9, so there may be something. Jeff, I saw your hand first. Bonnie, and then we'll go to Don, and then Harvey.
I just missed your reference when he's talking about the palms in Leviticus.
23:40. All right, Bonnie?
I just wanted to mention that I think all of that shows that we should be doing this with joy also.
Yeah.
It, grudgingly, yeah. Because we think we have to, you know, willingly and with joy.
Yeah. And the presidential conventions, I think, are a good example of that. You can bust people in and force them to, you know, put a smile on the face and, okay, you know, wave for the guy when the time is right. And there are people who will do that when it comes to Christianity. You know, they're pushed by mom or dad, or they're pushed by, you know, some other influence or something else in life. But it's kind of like when Paul talked about giving in the 2 Corinthians letter. He said, do not do it in a grudging way. And, you know, God's not interested. Well, that's not a good way to say it. That's not the kind of spirit that God desires. So people sometimes start off on that track and they get that corrected and worked out, thankfully. But that's definitely not the right course, try to serve God with and on. Okay, Don, I think you and then Harvey.
Maybe a stupid question or thought. We in the church today, when we get to heaven, we understand God and the Lamb and Jesus. What about the elect before that are in Hades? You know, when they get to heaven, will
know, there are a lot of interesting questions there, and the question can be expanded a little bit. What about infants? If someone has died in the womb, you know, they never saw the light of day, if you will. How is that going to work? Is God going to cause them to somehow grow up? Are they, you know, we don't seem to, from our perspective, have a difficulty. If somebody lives to 114, and another fellow, let's say the prime of life is 35, all right, we, from our perspective, usually don't have much difficulty with a 35-year-old thinking, okay, heaven's going to be great for him, I mean, or her. But the fellow who's 114, we're kind of thinking, well, you know, how's God going to kind of, you know, adjust that so they can, I mean, well, yeah, you know, they're going to get kind of a new body and things. So we struggle a little bit with the old. But when we think about the folks who were never born and never even had a chance to come to that limited knowledge that people, for example, that you mentioned, you know, would have lived prior to the Christian era, those kinds of things, I do not know the answer to those questions.
Well, was Abraham was there with
sure.
Christ, so we can assume from that example that they will have.
The best illustration that I can give you, the best answer I can give you, is thinking about what happened at the Transfiguration, Matthew 17. Now you have two Old Testament characters that show up with the Lord. They were very apparently comfortable with Jesus. And well, let's go back and actually look at that.
Matthew 17.
We have in verse 3 of Matthew 17, and behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with him. And I was thinking we had some other information in there. Maybe it's in Luke's account as far as what they were saying. Let's take a look. Maybe it's in Luke 17, and maybe my memory's just failed a little bit, but we do know that they were talking about some things. I was thinking that there was some information specifically about Jesus and some things that were going to take place as far as his future. Well, offhand, I don't see it in Matthew's account. It may be in a parallel account, but we do know, at least from Matthew 17, the first few verses, that Jesus was talking to them. Anybody have the other accounts there? Let's see if we can pull up the other accounts of the
translation.
Luke 9. Okay. Luke 9, 29.
You started 28.
Wait, you said Luke 9? I'm in Luke 9, Harvey, and I'm not seeing.
49.
Okay, 49.
Maybe.
Yeah, I see. Thank you. Luke 9:30. Yeah, you got Peter, John, James. That's in 28. He's praying. He's changed. And then in verse 30, and behold, there talked with him two men who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spake of his decease. There it is. They spoke about his death, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, that would suggest to me, Don, that if they had received some kind of insight about that, maybe in the Hadean realm, they didn't have all the details. So here you have God communicating with these men, describing what took place. Now, it's a bit of a leap, but I don't think it's too many steps forward to say, if it was important enough for Jesus to discuss these important spiritual matters with these two fellows, then as people enter into eternity, would this same God not talk to his people about what has taken place? It seems to me that will occur. Let's read ahead a little bit. Let's take a look at this. Is a very, very difficult passage. And I've been wrestling with it for a couple of weeks, and I'm kind of hesitant to say that I've got it figured out, but we'll introduce it now. Maybe some of you will have some additional thoughts from Revelation 8 when we get over here, and you can help me out a little bit more. But look at Revelation 8, verse 1 and following. And when he opened the seventh seal, we've talked about the first six up to this point, there followed a silence in heaven about the space of a half an hour. Now, remember, we've said that the first six seals describe things associated with this earth. Seventh seal is going to take us to the time when the Lord has returned and, you know, people are ready to go into heaven and hell. So Revelation 8, we're talking about eternity. John says, and I saw the seven angels that stand before God, and there were given unto them seven trumpets. And another angel came and stood over the altar having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should add it what? Unto the prayers of who? All the saints. Now, here's what puzzles me a little bit about this. If this seventh seal is describing the time that will occur after, why on earth are prayers mentioned? In the presence of God, I pray. Isn't prayer something for them? I think to the prayers of the saints and the smoke of the incense, and the angel taketh the censer and fill it with a fire, and he casts it on the earth, and the voices, lightnings, and an earthquake. I'm going to tie this in with Luke chapter 18, where Jesus, the thunders, lightnings, the earthquake, I think that this is a reference to punishing the unsaved. When you, let's him to avenge fire, he's going to punish the unrighteous and the people who oppressed you, for the people who afflicted you. You live maybe 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years waiting for vindication, and it never seemed to come. God says day's a day. So, will people at that time have an understanding? Oh, hey, my prayer is finally answered. Now my prayer that I uttered 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 500 years ago has finally been answered. Will they see it? So they have an understanding of that. Now, if they understand that, Don, as far as the prayer concerning vindication, it seems to me that with some items that are more important, as far as Jesus and a sacrifice, that that understanding will also somehow come. Now, will that be a gradual thing? Will there somehow be knowledge that's just instantly zapped into people? I don't know exactly how the process is going to work. But it does seem to me that that information will somehow be communicated, whether it's an instant thing or whether it's going to be an ongoing thing. Seems to me, and this is going to be the position to take with the class, that on that day when we stand before God, what we typically refer to as a day of judgment, a day of sentencing, if you will, it will be on that people at that point see the vindication. After Revelation 6. In the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of them that had been slain for the word of God. Now, to me, it sounds like these people are dead. They've been killed. And they were killed for their faith. And for the testimony which they held. They cried with a great voice, saying what? How long? So, we want to be careful as far as what we conclude with respect to feelings that, you know, continue on, that they will have done. And when they well, again, we want to be careful as far as how we treat. The God of justice, isn't he? This requires certain things. You know, you have a fellow who is somehow involved in executing a person. It's not that he hates man. You know, he's never met the man. He has nothing on which, you know, let's say he's never even seen the court case against the fellow. But here's a case where justice requires death. And, you know, he is involved in carrying out that particular sentence. So it is possible to separate justice from a bloodthirsty desire for vengeance. I'm not suggesting that the saved will have a bloodthirsty. That's right. Therefore what? This is the consequence. You know, you may have a situation, a work situation, where an employer really likes an employee. Maybe it's a family member. I mean, it is his favorite employee. And yet the employee becomes involved with drugs. And it's a situation where the family member says, I'm not going to get off the drugs. And maybe the job that's, you know, being done by that person is a job where, I mean, you know, drugs will put his life and the lives of others in jeopardy. What do you have to do if you're going to be responsible? You've got to let him go. You've got to fire him. Now, you don't like that. You don't want that. But this is what's proper and this is what's right. And that, to me, would be the emphasis here, that it's going to be a matter of justice. It needs to be served. We've asked for it to be served, and God says it will be served. Oh, okay. 16 and 17.
Seven.
Okay. Where are we at here?
No more tears.
Okay.
Jive, like that.
Well, I think when we get there, I think it will jive. But we don't want to get so far ahead that... I know, there are just all kinds of great questions that we can answer, but I promise, unless the Lord comes or I die, we're going to make progress towards that end.
You talk about these prayers.
I think that's true. Sure. But when we think about prayer, how do I want to express this so it makes more sense instead of less sense? If you... Let's... Trace, do you want to take a shot at this?
I've been trying.
Okay. Yeah, and that's kind of the thing that I was going. Let's go back and use a presidential expression. You know, if you want to make contact with President Obama, can you just go into his presence and say, "Oh, hi, Mr. President"? You have to make supplication, right? You can send an email. You're not going to be able to get him on the phone probably unless you're, you know, related to him. But you can try to send an email, or you can send a letter and possibly have, you know, basically indirect communication. When you think about prayer, it kind of takes that same form. It's not direct communication with God. But after people are in the presence of God, what happens to that access? It's now unlike it was before, right? I mean, bang, you're right there in the presence of God. So when we think about prayer, I guess I'm trying to express the idea that it's like that letter to the president. It's a less direct form of access. So there's still going to be communication, but it's not going to be communication in the sense of prayer as we think of it now. You know, there's going to be, much more direct communication.
We don't need Jesus as the intercessor anymore because we'll have direct communication. That's right.
We'll be face-to-face.
Face-to-face, basically, yes. The same kind of thing. And we recognize that in other things. You know, a spouse is away or a friend's away and we can't communicate face-to-face, so we have to use a telephone or email, you know, means of communication. And that's what I'm trying to communicate with prayer. The communication is going to be much more direct. And, you know, I would imagine the response is going to be probably a lot more immediate. But yes, prayer, worship, or worship, those kinds of things, I would agree 100%. Harvey?
Get back to the Bride of Christ. A name is pretty important. When you stop and think you're the bride, you actually want her to carry your name, right?
Yeah.
So what about all the churches around here that carry a different name? That's boggling to my mind.
Yeah.
Because it's so simple to see that the church was the Bride of Christ. Why wouldn't it carry the name of Christ? How do people think? I wouldn't want her to carry, be married to her and carry her maiden name Weaver. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. And a question that some people have never considered, and it would be a thought-provoking question. Person says, well, I don't think the name matters. Well, let's put your name on the sign. Let's call it Harvey's Church, if you were having a conversation with somebody. And most people, I think, would recoil at that. Well, that's not right. Well, why not? Whose name should be on it?
It's not my church.
Okay. Well, whose is it?
Christ.
Well, then let's honor him. You know, let's honor deity instead of some person or some religious act. But a lot of people, that's a point that they've not really thought through very well, but it's definitely worthy of consideration. Okay, Revelation, unless we've got another hand that somebody really wants to communicate something. Dolores?
No, I'm trying to communicate. I'm just trying to get my head around the whole chapter.
Okay.
The seal was open, and we've got the prayers of the saints were on the altar.
Okay, is this an 8? You're an 8. Okay, I probably shouldn't have opened up that can. If you want to ask a quick question, I'll try to answer it.
No, it's not going to be quick.
Okay. Like I say, I've wrestled this with this for a long time, and my buddy in Kentucky, who's done a lot of studying Revelation, I threw it by him, and he said, "I think you're on the right track." I've gone further with it than he has, and I still may be off track, but and I still may put some additional things together. But I don't want to get so far out of sequence where we just kind of get off track. So let's try to pick up at least 10 through 12 and make some more progress in 10. So appreciate your interest, but...
I have one question.
Okay.
One comment I wanted to make. Yes, you were talking about the day and night.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whether it's the middle of the night, whether it's 3 o'clock in the morning, that my heart should be with God day and night. And to me, that's what day and night means versus people on the other side of the world, because it's daytime when they're, even though it's night here, it's daytime there. To me, the day and night meant how I conduct my life no matter what hour I am up and awake.
Right. I'm glad that you mentioned that. A lot of times I bring in some notes that for whatever reason don't get used. In this particular case, I omitted that point, but I did have down there as far as Romans 12 verse 1. Remember, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice. So when we think about the point that you made, it ties in perfectly well with Romans 12 verse 1. So from our perspective, yes, all of life is not worship, but all of our life should be devoted to serving God throughout the day. We are mindful that we are His people, we are His servants. So night and day, from that perspective as well, would also be true. But there's that.
I shouldn't be living one way at
right.
in the daytime, and then if I'm
sure.
up at 3 o'clock at night, out doing something that is against God's work.
Exactly right. We've committed ourselves to God. We want to be the very best people that we can be too. So yes, I would also argue that that is definitely part of the point. So people all over the world, and people when they have that kind of commitment, it really makes the thought stand out. So very, very good. Okay, let's see if we can squeeze in most of chapter 7, 10 through 12. 10 says, "And they cry with a great voice, saying, Salvation unto our God, who sitteth on the throne and unto the Lamb. And all the angels were standing round about the throne, and about the elders and the four living creatures. And they fall before the throne on their faces, and worshiping God, saying, Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be unto our God forever and ever. Amen." Now, we've said before, remember this great multitude of 144,000 describing God's people on the earth. They're honoring God. The point that Betty just made, Romans chapter 12, our lives are committed to God. People are doing that around the world. Some are in heaven, some are on earth. And now we see this being described with a loud voice. That is, people are really, really enthused about God and what He's done for His people. When you think about this praise, what's the emphasis on? Starts with S, ends with N. No, the emphasis here is not on sin, it's on salvation. Glory, honor, praise to God, especially Christ, for salvation. So when we think about this, man, as we mentioned, will certainly somehow be involved with worship in eternity, but also as we think about our life on earth, there should be a great concentration, a great focus on salvation. Though that's the case, what do we often find when it comes to quote-unquote church in the religious world? The emphasis isn't on salvation, what God's done for people, it's on let's be entertained, isn't it? Let's become involved with social programs. Well, not all of those are bad, but the focus should be on spiritual things, especially what God has done for His people. Now, it's very interesting. The praise that's described here is very similar to the praise that we see across the page, Revelation 5:12, saying with what kind of voice? A great voice, the same thing. "Worthy is the Lamb that hath been slain to receive the power, the riches, the wisdom, the might, and honor, and glory, and blessing." When we look at these two praises, one of the things that stands out to me is in Revelation chapter 5, the praise is directed to Jesus. And then over here in Revelation chapter 7, the praise, which is essentially the same, is directed to the Father. When we consider this, what's it suggest to us? Same praise is directed to the Son as is directed to the Father. It sounds like Yeah, the Father and Son are both equal as far as status. They're both deity and thus both worthy of praise. When we look at the praise, any idea on how many different items are mentioned? If you count them up? Oh, there just happens to be seven. Seven in Revelation chapter 5, seven in Revelation chapter 7. Well, do you think John only meant seven, or do you think he meant, I've got a symbol here?
Complete.
All right, complete, perfect. You know, all these things certainly would have been involved, but it was another way of saying God deserves to be praised, he deserves to be honored in every possible way. This other quick point, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask. This is the only passage in the New Testament that begins and ends with the word Amen. So, John, as he describes this, very, very important, very, very appropriate to praise God for who he is and what he's done.